Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Robin Hatch is a neoclassical Canadian composer and multi-instrumentalist currently based in Burlington, Ontario. Emerging as a dynamic artistic force in Toronto over the past decade, Hatch has played in bands like Sheezer, not to mention a special events and wedding band with me when I lived in Guelph. On her own, Hatch has explored transcribed improvisation while also applying traditional classical structures to modern melodic ideas over the course of four albums. Her latest release is 2021's Tonto, which was recorded over 4 days in February 2021 on the famed Tonto synthesizer at the National Music Center in Calgary, Alberta. With guest spots by the likes of Eric Slick from Dr. Dog, Leland Whitty from Bad Bad Not Good, doom metal violinist Laura Bates of Velour, drummer Lowell Whitty, Nick Thorburn from Islands, and saxophonist Joseph Shabison, Tonto is a towering achievement and prompted Hatch and I to have a good chat about pandemic life in Ontario and why she hit the road to meet with famed Stevie Wonder producer and electronic music pioneer Robert Margalef, early Moog synthesizers and George Harrison and Annette Peacock, the Blink 155 podcast and its hosts Josiah Hughes and Sam Sutherland, Rick Rubin, Def Leppard, and Weezer, Jim Guthrie and the Three Gut Records Party at the Transac, how the Beatles couldn't read music, giggling at Grimes, Steve Albini's Twitter and provoking people on socials, Kanye West and Bob Dylan almost playing with Dweezil Zappa, touring with Fucked Up, Tonto appearing on vinyl, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, with additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find titles, all of which you can learn more about at their website, blackbird.ca, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 659th episode of Creative Control, featuring the brilliant and charming Robin Hatch, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Robin. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for asking. Where in the world are you?
I am in Burlington, Ontario right now.
Burlington, Ontario. That's not where I think of Robin Hatch being, you know, hanging out in Burlington. What brings you to Burlington?
I live at my parents, so that's where they live.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you were kind of a Toronto person. Sorry. Is that?
Oh, no, it's okay. I mean, it's somewhat because of the pandemic, but...
Right.
No, I know I seem like a very urban kind of hip. I should be downtown somewhere.
Have you ever lived in Toronto?
Yeah, I lived there for 10 years.
Right. Okay. So it's not completely outlandish of me to it. I think I knew you as anytime we've connected for interviews or whatever, for the most part, I think you've been in Toronto. I'm talking like pre you being like a solo person. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that was true. Like when we did Long Winter, I guess it was 2 years ago now, I would have been in Burlington, but
yeah,
it's funny because earlier today I thought of it as just 1 year ago and had to do a reality check.
Yeah. Well, how are things going in Burlington in a general sense? I know from what I've been reading, and I try not to read anything anymore, like in terms of, I read books and magazines, but I try not to read the news as much. But from what I can tell, as we're speaking, Ontario is in a, I don't think free fall is the right word, because it's actually, everything's going up. The case numbers are like 10,000 people a day all of a sudden. Is that correct?
Yeah, the numbers are pretty crazy. Sometimes I push the button and Google Ontario COVID cases and it'll say, something I noticed 2 days ago is the main variable on the graph is tests, like amount of tests taken. So that number looks like it's skyrocketed. And then way below that is the amount of cases, which it is also high. But the good news is, I guess, the death rates aren't very high.
Yeah, that's what
so
I'm hearing.
Keep that in mind, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Because here's the thing, Robin. During the pandemic, yes, so you and I'm trying to think here. I feel like we did one thing for Long Winter, I mean. January 2020, I had already moved to Edmonton from Ontario, and so I decided, but there was talk of me still doing that Long Winter talk show. So you were my panel guest remotely. I did it remotely, and I was on a computer, right? Is that what happened?
Yeah, and you had a cool theme song with your kids.
That's right, and my daughter more or less fell in love with you. She just became very smitten with you and your music and just something about you she really liked. And who doesn't like you, first of all? Let me just say that. It's not just my daughter. But anyway, yeah, she became I mentioned that I was talking to you and I tried to give her some. They don't have good memories, you know, children sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I gave her some context. I said, yeah, you know, she was on the talk show. She's like, she played the piano? I'm like, yes. That's right. So she remembers that part. And we were listening to the new record in the house, and she. I mean, what they think is it sounds like video game music. But anyway, we can talk
that's
about
great.
That's
yeah.
something. Yeah, we'll talk about that maybe later. But anyway, okay, so yeah, January 2020, I beamed in and you were my like interview guest. And I think that went okay, as I recall. But then I decided to fly home in February, which was the last time I was in Ontario. February 2020 was to basically come and see my parents and my friends and do Long Winter. And then you were the musical director, right, for my show? Is that what happened?
Oh, yeah. I came back the next month and was the, like, Paul Schaefer to your Letterman.
That's correct. That's exact. That was you picked the right two people, first of all. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Oh, I can't think of any Questlove.
Yeah, no. Don't talk about that other show. I don't like that show. But yeah,
okay.
The Paul and, or Max Weinberg and Conan O'Brien, maybe. I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That one was pretty good. But anyway, you did live music. And so that's the last time. And we were in the same room for that, right? I was there. You were there. We were both there, right? Is that what happened?
Yeah, we were both there.
Yeah. And then, of course, the next month, March 2020, there was a lockdown or whatever. Like, yeah, there was a lockdown. Mm-hmm. The pandemic was really in full force. And then you and I I don't know what the word is, but we're social media friends. So I would see you traveling, I thought. It seemed to me, unless you did some sort of bizarre made-up thing on Photoshop, but it seemed to me that during everyone
did a really cool bit
yeah where you're like, hey, I'm in Arizona, I'm at the Grand Canyon or whatever. I feel like those are
I did go there.
You did. So what? Okay, so this is what I don't get. I felt like the world was locked down. You seem to be traveling, I assume for work, but also not. Like, what were you doing in all that time when everyone else was like, don't leave your house? You were like circumnavigating at least North America, is that right?
As soon as I got the vaccine, well, I live with my folks and one of them's autoimmune condition. So it's been a very intense year. So as soon as they got the vaccines, it was like a weight off my shoulders. And then as soon as I got the vax, I needed to get my album mastered. So I went down to get it mastered by Robert Margolef, who was one of the two businessmen behind the Tonto Synth. And he produced Freedom of Choice and...
By Devo.
Yeah, and one of the early Oingo Boingo records.
Oh, okay.
As well as those two Stevie, the three Stevie Wonder Intervisions, Talking Book and Music of My Mind.
Holy Lord, okay, wow, well, there you go.
So the main reason was to get the album mastered, and then I guess I decided to book an extra week and drove through... the border of Arizona and Utah, and then back down through the Grand Canyon.
I see. Okay. So it was a business trip, and it wasn't, you weren't, whatever. You weren't just like, I feel like now's the time to take a little trip.
Yeah.
So where is Robert based, though?
In LA.
In LA. Okay. So you went down there, and then and what was that like just traveling? Am I correct, though, timeline-wise? So you were vax, so that must have been after... when did we start getting vaccinated? April? June? When was that? I don't remember.
Yeah. I had my second vax in June.
Right. Of
like the first week of June.
2021? 2021. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You're right. Everything's blurred together. We did not have any vaccinations for all of 2020, right? We didn't start getting stuff. Okay. So all of this travel I'm thinking of was after the vaccines. Is that fair?
Yeah. I'd say the trip to Calgary to do the residency at the NMC. That was more intense in terms of stress about COVID.
Right.
Because that was still when it was kind of don't touch your face vibes in the press, and there were no vaccines yet in Canada.
Was it hard for you not to touch your face?
A bit, but it's funny how just hearing the government demands this made it a bit easier, I guess.
Right.
My skin got better, I think.
Did you find that because we learned a lot about ourselves in terms of, we learned that men don't wash their hands. That's the one thing I was like, what the hell? I'll tell you, so it's not even the pandemic anymore. I still have decided to wear the rubber gloves in the grocery store because I'm like, the one thing I really took away from this is that everyone's pretty goddamn gross and they're not washing their hands. So if they're rifling through the, whatever I'm rifling through, the granola bars or the quinoa or whatever the hell it is, you know, who knows what's on their hands. So then I said,
yeah, you don't want their poop particles.
Yes, exactly.
Granola
exactly.
box.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Disgusting. So I still am doing that. And when I have to go to the Costco sometimes to feed the family here. So I go there and it's like crazy a number of people. And I just decide, you know what? Why don't I just keep wearing the things? And you get the odd look still. But anyway, that's what I learned. But did you learn? They were trying to teach us that we maybe touched our faces too much. You're right. And there are all sorts of strange things. Like it already feels quaint, the early days, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like I was, do you watch Better Call Saul?
Of course. Yes. I love that show. Yes.
You know
yes.
when Chuck would wear the kind of tinfoil blazer and freak out kind of going to the grocery store? That was definitely my frame of mind for probably the first 3 months of the pandemic.
Oh, okay. You were really affected by...
stressed. Yeah.
I couldn't tell. See, you seem very chill and cavalier in some ways. That's why I wasn't sure. I just assumed, again, the timelines are all blurring. So I'm like, to be honest, I was like, if Robin's traveling around, maybe it's fine. Like, I actually had that brief thought. I wasn't being judgy. I was like, well, maybe it's fine. I don't know what's going on. But you were one of the people where I'd see you doing stuff and be like, she's in Calgary during the pandemic. Like, you know, I'm here. We didn't reach out to one another to be like, hey, you're around. I feel like I did sort of say, like, holy shit, you're actually... Did we connect? I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, I got the email in January that... Because Alberta had just gone into some other phase of lockdown, and I had gotten the residency before the pandemic. It was supposed to be 3 weeks. They said, we can do it now. It'll be 6 days. So I was just kind of desperate to get out of the house at that point, so... But something that's interesting is I feel like I'm lucky to have been friends with Americans throughout the pandemic because their attitude towards COVID and masks and everything, like I disagree with some of the fundamentals, but they are a bit more ideologically free and as a result didn't seem to worry about it as much when I was there. Versus in Canada, it's almost still more stressful now, even when there were no lockdowns than it was in the States.
That's fact. I've never heard in the last few years, particularly 10 years, I've never heard anyone describe America as being a little more ideologically free. They seem
that's their
very,
whole thing.
Do you think so? Like, I feel like they're very tied to various ideologies. That's why they're so fractured. But you think they're... Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding what you mean. You just feel
I
like
guess that,
they're...
Maybe that they're ideologically freedom based, so...
Oh, I see what you're saying. They're free
while that,
of... Right, I see.
Which, unfortunately, leads itself to more extreme viewpoints, but... And things like... I feel like the nursing home thing here, just reading about that for me was enough to make me want to never leave the house. Mm. I felt so bad. And I don't think it's the same in the States.
Right, I see. Okay.
But they're, in general, just a bit less worried, I think, about... scary plague virus.
When you say Americans are less worried, are you saying that in juxtaposition to me specifically? Do you feel like I'm too worried? I feel like I am a little too worried, but I don't think people are taking it that... I live in Alberta. You have to understand that.
Right, right.
And people don't take it that seriously. And then they get, as you may have heard, at the peak... Before, like, this government here would just lift all they could. They lifted almost everything, and then our rates went sky high. We were like worst. We were the worst in North America. This province was the worst of any place, any state in America, any province in Canada. We had the worst case counts. So, like, I think my perspective is different because I'm in a place that there's cognitive dissonance. So when you live in, like, when I was talking to my sister and her partner, they're in Nova Scotia. So they have a totally different environment compared to where we live. So, like, I mean, even when I was talking to them, like, yeah, it's minus 36 degrees Celsius here. And they're like, oh, it's plus one. I'm like, okay. That's, as you know, Robin, that's quite different. So anyway, yeah, I think depending on where you live, maybe, like, as I said, as I started this, like, Ontario is not doing well as we're speaking, right? It's doing very, like, 5 weeks ago, I feel like Ontario was like 200 cases a day. And then this variant came about, and now you're at 10,000 cases a day. Are things locked down? Like, are you not allowed to do certain things that you could, like, 5-6 weeks ago?
Yeah, they reduced venue capacity. I think around the second week of December, Doug Ford kind of got his mind right, and that's when everything kind of got, Christmas and New Year's events got canceled. But I wonder if it has to do with the land border reopening as well for Ontario, and that's why it's not as high in...
They left the border thing open, even though there's the rise and everything? I thought they would have shut that
down.
Oh, okay.
So that may have something to do with it.
You know, this is what I don't like about it, Robin. There's no consistency. I don't like it. I try to be consistent. So there's no one's acting in a way that, like, it's like everything's precedented now, right? Like, it's not unprecedented anymore what's happening. When the cases go up, don't you think we should, I know you don't, you think we worry too much, but don't you think we should just go back?
No, I don't think that.
Okay. Don't you think we should lock down again when the cases go up to 10,000 a day? Like the way we did when it started? Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah. And it's like we're all in a cult and the leader of the cults are government leaders and they're doing kind of intermittent reinforcements, making us all freak out.
Yeah. It is. Anyway, it's very bizarre. So when were you in Calgary? Because I thought it was during, based on what you're saying, I thought it was February 2020, but it was actually, was it February 2021 that you were in Calgary making the record?
Yeah, it was March 2021, I guess. February, March.
Okay, so so you were here, so that's this year. So wow, this is a quick turnaround on this record then, because as we're speaking, it is still 2021. We should probably explain what this record's all about. I will say, just to preemptively suggest to you, that I have actually visited the National Music Center in Calgary and got a tour of Tonto. Or rather, I got a tour of the facility, rather. Our family did. I want to say it was in 2018. And
was it with Jason?
No, it was a person named Kay, I don't know if... Kay worked.
I don't think
I knew from her time with the Daniel Romano universe. Kay used to collaborate there, and I didn't know Kay worked there. I just someone saw that I was my family and I were in the area on vacation. This is obviously 2018, well before we moved here. But my wife's family's from here, so we were visiting them in the summer, and we were in Canmore, and I was posting photos, and someone someone who works for the NMC saw that and said, hey, if you're on your way back to Edmonton, do you want to swing by here and get a tour? That's the power of social media, is all I'm saying, Robin. That's pretty amazing, don't you think?
And
it's great. So we said sure, you know, we were on our way back. So we went in, got like a apparently, like, I think we got like the special tour, like we got to do stuff that some people, I'm not bragging.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not bragging here. I'm just saying that was nice. My son and I.
Yeah, I got the same one. We're exclusive. That's VIP.
Yeah, that's right. So let's just revel in we don't have very much going on in our lives that's special, do we, Robin? Let's revel.
No.
Revel in our access to the National Music Center. Anyway, my son and I, got to hang out for a little bit inside the Rolling Stones mobile studio unit that they have there, the truck. Do you know that thing? Did you get to go to that?
Yeah, I saw it. I went in there. It's so cool.
It's really rad. So it was really fun. Anyway, full-on tour of this thing called Tonto, which is an acronym. Can you tell the folks at home what this is and what you got to do with it? Can you do that?
Yes. So... okay, I did this a bunch for my PR. Let's see how I can do off the cuff.
It's been a few months, right, since this record came out. So are you rusty? Do you feel like you haven't done a spiel in a while?
I think I've got it in my long-term memory at this point. We'll see.
Okay.
So Tonto stands for the Original New Timbral Orchestra, and it's a sort of Franken-synth that was built in the early 60s by these two guys, Malcolm Cecil, who was the primary engineer, and Robert Margalef, who was his sort of musical and business partner. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm was an engineer, and Robert was... He was a Cold War photographer, I think, in the Andy Warhol's factory scene. Oh. He filmed the first Edie Sedgwick movie and had also gone to Tanglewood as a baritone, I think, growing up. So he had a classical background. And the first Moogs had just been released. And Malcolm created Tonto, I think, essentially just as an experimental art project to start. And... It combines two Moog modular 3 systems and two ARP 2600 synthesizers, as well as sort of a bunch of custom Surge and Oberheim modules. And he created one of the first universal voltage systems so that all of the synths could play together as sort of a freestanding automaton without the voltage breaking. And he jerry-rigged cables from old 747s and then... I think like the main power cables from the original Apollo 11 mission.
Wait, just so a second. Just a second. So this is it's a musical instrument, but you just invoked an Apollo mission and a 747, like a jet. Do you mean like an airplane?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's aeronautics involved in this music making device.
Yeah, totally. And he also used a joystick from a model or like a remote control airplane to create the first pitch shift so that the Moog could stay in tune, because that was sort of the main problem with the early analog synthesizers is that they always detuned themselves. It was sort of impossible to function. So with this pitch shift, which is sort of like a joystick, he could keep it in tune. And that's how they originally got set up with Stevie Wonder, because they had the only... Moog in New York that would stay in tune.
Oh.
Yeah, it was kind of cool.
Now, I think, so early Moog explorers, do you know Annette Peacock?
I know the name. I'm kind of a poser, to be honest.
Okay. No.
I know Tonto quite well.
Yeah, so Annette Peacock, I believe, got maybe like the first one. Annette Peacock is a musician. I got to interview Annette at Pop Montreal, and I feel like she was given like the first one. You should check out her music. It's great. And she's... odd. When we interviewed, she like knew Elvis and like met Elvis, and like when he was like a young Elvis, and got to go to, like, Elvis invited her and her friends to a party at Graceland, and they got to go. And Annette told me the story that what she really didn't like about the experience was that when Elvis would ask like his the people who worked at his house, you know, like the and the people like working at the party to do something, they would like make fun of him when he left. Like roll their eyes and make fun of Elvis.
That's terrible.
Yeah, so she
must have been really rude to them when they were.
No. Apparently, apparently he was not rude to anyone. He was very kind, and so I think that came across. He was generally pretty sweet. I mean, until like the late 60s, when I mean, imagine being Elvis. He's like the first child star. Anyway, he lost his mother. He's got some. He had a lot of trauma. Anyway,
yeah, he had a reason. Yeah, he was allowed to be like that.
He was a little off, but he was also very happy. And I think her thing was he seemed very sweet. They were very mean to him. Anyway, she got one of the first Moogs, and it was like ginormous. Like it was not like what we know. Like you'd pack it in a taxi cab with your Moog, right? It was you needed like a truck to move these things, right? I mean, the thing you're talking about, Tonto. I'm also, you know, I don't know about you. I'm very immersed in Beatles land right now because of the Get Back document. I'm always kind of, they're always on my mind. But I watched the Get Back thing, and now I'm reading a book, or rereading a book called And in the End. And George Harrison also had a very early Moog, and he put it all over Abbey Road.
Really?
Yeah, so he got one of the first ones too, and so they were making Abbey. It's not on the Let It Be sessions because he didn't have it quite yet.
No.
But he got it like within. That's so crazy how fast the Beatles work. So 69, they're doing that Let It Be thing, and then before the end of the year, they make Abbey Road. Like they go through all that turmoil that everyone's talking about that's depicted in Get Back, and then they make Abbey Road, which is a superior record and a more seriously made record. But he gets a Moog and starts to just add it to I Want You, She's So Heavy, and Here Comes
yeah,
the
like
Sun.
Sun King, yeah.
Sun King, and Because, and that's all. In retrospect, he said it was all so rudimentary because no one had ever used them before. So anyway, all this to say, like, it sounds like Malcolm Cecil and Robert Margoliff, they were probably on the first floor of it too, right? Like in the earliest days of the Moogs, that's where they started to interact with them. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what kind of made that duo unique was that Malcolm was coming at it from a physics perspective and understood the mechanics of how to get everything to function in a particular way, which was maybe why it was able to get on so many records then. Mm. Versus kind of what you were saying about George Harrison, or I guess Gary Numan, where the Moog is sort of a basic tool that your creative energy can build just off of basics rather than trying to be as complicated as possible.
Well, you're a multi-instrumentalist, but you're frequently called upon to play some keyboards. And is your background probably what? We've talked about this before, I'm pretty sure, but you have a classical music background, right?
Yep.
And a piano is your primary instrument, if you will, your first one?
Yes, yes.
Right. I just am curious, and this might seem obvious, but what is it about, like, a synthesizer or the Moogs that we're talking about? You know, on the face of it, they look like pianos. They have the same interface, if you will. They've got keys and you play. What is it in your mind, as someone with your background and your skill set, what is it about, like, wouldn't it be cool to not just play piano, but play like a fucked up sounding piano? You know, like, why do you get drawn to the, not discordant or distorted, but just like the tweaked version of the same thing? Does that make sense? Like, what is it about, can you kind of characterize what appeals to you about playing that foundational instrument, but having it sound totally weird and strange?
I think it's maybe similar to acoustic versus electric guitar is probably the most obvious comparison, where there's a whole world of pedals and tones that you can get into with electric guitar that you couldn't with acoustic.
Sure.
And I mean, my favorite music is sort of 70s, 80s, top 40. So I think then the synth was this, you know, before, I guess, Toto won the Grammy for Album of the Year and synth music kind of went on the outs for a bit. It was the sound of space. Like, it was I wasn't alive at this time, but from what I gather from absorbing it through pop culture, it did seem to be the sound of the future at the time, sort of contacting space, science fiction. So I think that's maybe what drew me to it, is attempting to connect with the musicians that I feel sort of the music that I like from the 70s and 80s. So how do I get those sounds?
Well, you talked about acoustic and electric, and that can be said of pianos as well, not just guitars, it could be of pianos. But there's also, I think, fundamentally, is there something going on there, Robin, do you think, about like reality versus surrealism? Like, are you drawn to surrealism in any other sense of the word?
I think so, yeah. I think there's more, I'm coming at it from more of a pragmatic perspective.
Yeah.
There's more room for error on synthesizers. So if you mess up and a professional synth player is listening, they'll be more likely to call that just a happy accident or something like that, versus classical piano, where it's a professional classical pianist listening to it would know that you were messing up.
That's fascinating, because I had been mucking around on my my kid's brand new electric keyboard. I got him.
Oh yeah, did you end up getting the Yamaha?
Yeah, or? Did I ask you about this? I did, didn't I? What did I get? The Yamaha. I can't remember, but you told me. Did you tell me to get it? I don't remember.
Actually, you just told me that you got it.
Oh, I did. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I was pulling.
No, you got the right one though. That's cool.
Yeah, it's like pretty multifaceted, and it wasn't particularly cheap or expensive. It was like whatever. But I don't know how to play really, but I don't know how to play piano, but I'm trying to figure it out just because I spent $800 on my kid's keyboard, and he only plays it for like half an hour a day. I figure someone's got to get their money's worth, you know? So I go down there, and I try to play, and I try to figure out, I'm just trying to figure out where all the notes are and stuff, you know, how you have to do it. But I sometimes will change the setting from piano to organ or electric piano, because it's got those settings. And I find that I noticed my mistakes more on the regular piano setting, the grand piano setting. But when mm-hmm. I play on the organ, I'm sure I'm making the same mistakes. What I've tried to teach myself to do is just play the same chord progression until I feel like I can. Again, Robin, you know this. We've played music together. I don't know what I'm doing. But I try to play. And
you're good. Come on.
Well, I can't really do much. I do what I can. But I piano, for sure, it's always just mystified me. I think my parents weren't really supportive of me and my interest in music, playing music. They just didn't, and really even listening to it. There's something, they didn't really like it. They thought it was leading me astray, that I would be, you know.
I can relate to that.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, what I'm saying is I find I notice my mistakes more when I'm doing the same three chord progression on the piano than the other synthesized sounds. So I feel like it's actually, you're saying it's the opposite, that synthesizer players would be like, ha ha ha, you're making a mistake.
No, that's the, I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, you are. Okay, there's more. Yeah. There's more leeway with the synthesis. Like, yeah. Okay, I get it now. Okay, so
like I put out a synth album, I guess in 2019, because I wanted to get kind of a composer residency at the CFC, and I figured, ooh, they'll be impressed if I say I've put out an experimental synth record. So I just hit record in for 6 hours, and then took 9 10-minute chunks.
Right,
and you know. Call myself Tangerine Dream, but and then didn't get the residency. But it, I'm much more comfortable doing that on synthesizer than piano.
I see. Okay, sorry. Just for people listening and even myself, what does CFC stand for?
Oh, the Canadian Film Center.
Oh, see, I didn't even know what that. I didn't know what the F stood for. I wouldn't have guessed film for some reason. Okay, so that and you get a residency. Where is that? Is that in Toronto?
It's in Toronto. Yeah, and they offer residencies that place composers with directors so that you can build a reel and, you know, get some great Canadian entertainment industry connections.
Sorry. I think you were being sincere with that, but it also sounded hilarious.
No, I was sorry. But at that point, like, I was broke, so I just, you know, I'll do whatever to try and gain some traction.
Have you done much film work or advertising work or anything like that?
No, I mean, not for lack of trying, but I have done some podcast work over the past year. I mm-hmm. wrote music for an episode of Blowback, season 2, which was really fun. And then the Truanon podcast, I did some music for an episode as well.
Isn't that a big deal, that one?
I think so. they kind of
That's a big show, isn't it? I thought that was a big show. So you just, is that just through networking, or do you have like a, are you in some sort of union where you get the work, or how does that work?
It was just through Twitter. That's a testament to the power of social media. I met one of the hosts of that podcast through the Blink-182 podcast community. Just
The Blink-155.
Yeah, Blink-155.
Right. Yeah, that thing's taken off. Or, well, is it? I can't remember. They got through all the songs. I was talking to Sam a couple months ago, and we talked a little bit. Shop. Sam Sutherland, one of the, hosts. Yeah, he's an old friend of mine.
Oh, so I know, but I guess the listeners don't necessarily.
Well, yeah, sorry. I'm trying. It's a weird thing, right? We're talking to each other, but I have to talk to you as though the people, you know, I'm talking to the listeners too. You see? That's how, sorry.
That's how become parasocial friends with us.
Anyway, so that show did well. So you, yes, and you were a guest on that show. Is that right?
I was a guest on Blink-155, I guess, the start of January 2019. And so a long time ago.
So the premise is that you talk, they don't always just talk about Blink-182. So did you end up talking with some degree of passion about that band, or what did you end up talking about?
I went on a Blink-182 episode, like while they were still doing those songs. I know they're not anymore, I guess I got into that podcast right around the time that we played that wedding in Allura, or was it Allura or Toronto?
You mean, in our band, the wedding band. Yeah.
Yeah, I just started listening to it because it was such a sort of nice disconnect from all the music I normally listen to, and I found the hosts really enjoyable to listen to.
Yeah, Sam and Josiah are great. But are you a fan of that Blink-182 band?
Mm, No, but I was enough of a fan that it was in, like, it was funny to me. Yes. As like a bit that was just funny for me myself that I was getting into it.
Yeah, fair enough. I've often had younger people on the show, younger than me anyway. They're not that much younger, like 10, 15 years, 10 years maybe younger than me, sometimes younger than that. But they'll start to extol the virtues of Blink-182. And all of my main memory of that band is just like at the end of my tenure of being like a devoted Much Music watcher. Mm-hmm. There was lots of videos by that band on. Like, that was my main exposure to them, was them making kind of ironic videos. And, like, some, I don't know, one of their albums had, like, a buxom nurse on it or something. And yeah. I was like, I don't really like this. Like, something about it, I don't really like stuff like that. I like doctors and nurses. I just didn't like the kind of, I don't like sexualized sexy, crap stuff like that. So I didn't know, but I didn't know if they were doing it ironically or not. I couldn't tell, but anyway, something about it didn't, it just wasn't my time to spend time with that band. And mm-hmm. but so many young people that I younger people that appear on this show will bring them up, and I'll be like, really? And then those guys started that podcast, and then you were on it anyway. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a whole and like when like in Canada here we have Exclaim magazine, and they have like a trending section of their website for like articles that are doing well, and that anytime they cover that band, if I go to that section, the trending section, yeah, there's two or three Blink-182 stuff. Like, they just seem very popular still. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and I like, we should also say that I probably, did we first encounter each other because you were in that band Sheezer?
Yep.
Right, that's right. You were on, we did an interview, right? We did a like.
We
a
did remote. An interview, but we played a set at E-Bar. It was your cover band that the Gordon brothers were in, and Sheezer played that show.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so... That's right. So Sheezer was a Weezer sort of tribute band, but it was all people who identified as women at the time, and you were in it. And that's how I think, yeah, that's pretty much how we met. Were you in other bands besides that one, like around that time in Toronto?
Not really. I guess I played in Henry Fabergé's band.
Oh, yeah.
A few times. And then the Jesse Latterout had a band called The Incidentals that I played in.
Okay. So you're in the periphery, at least, if not in it, like the kind of Toronto indie rock world.
Yeah.
So how does that happen? You come from a classic, and I know this is very common among Toronto musicians who are like yourself, like they get, they're formally trained and have a background in one thing, and then some enterprising indie rock person notices this somehow and says, hey, can you join our band? Like, mm-hmm. we need someone exactly with your skill set. I think, but at the same time, your whole life was basically devoted to classical music. How do you enter the indie rock realm exactly, Robin?
So I got into Weezer, I think, through MySpace. This is embarrassing. I was on a message board for a band called Rooney, which were on the OC, because I had a crush on a guy at my high school who really liked the OC, the TV okay. show.
Yeah, that was a popular show. I remember that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so this band Rooney wasn't very popular, but it... So the message board only had kind of six other girls my age, some of whom I'm still pretty close with. And
how old are you at this time?
33.
No. How old are you when you're
sorry.
On the message board?
I'm 14.
You're like, why is he suddenly acting like a border official? Tell me your age immediately. No, you were 13 and on this message board. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, or sorry. No, I would have been 15, grade 10.
Grade 10, 15. Okay, that's a pivotal, foundational time. You're getting into your own stuff.
Then I met, you know, Colin Medley?
Oh, well, yes, he's a dear, dear friend of mine. Yes, yes, he's one of my best friends, I guess, somehow.
Yeah, so I was in line for a Weezer concert, the first show they played. I think it was in 2004. Mm-hmm. And I was behind Colin Medley in line for the show. So we became friends just waiting outside for 5 hours. And
wait, was this at Ontario Place?
This was at the Cool House. They played with Ringside or something.
Okay.
Right when the Make Believe album with Beverly Hills. I think the album wasn't out yet, but Beverly Hills was.
Oh, I see. Do you know I saw them on the Blue Album tour?
That's great.
I saw them at the Cool House the day after Edgefest 95, which was commandeered by Sloan, the band Sloan. And then... Sloan did that, and it was announced as their final show. Everyone thought it was their last show, but they did end up playing an afternoon show in Buffalo. I feel like that Weezer show I saw at the... It was also, weirdly, at the Cool House, but I think it was called the Warehouse, maybe? Anyway, mm-hmm. Sloan went and played in Buffalo, and then they rushed back to see Weezer. So I ran into him, like, you know, I'm a kid at this point, so I mm-hmm. you see Sloan, you get freak out a little bit. So I did.
Yeah. Oh, I
like, oh my God, you're at the Weezer show. Anyway, and then I was also in the Weezer fan club. I was member 1234. That was my member number. So.
Oh, cool. So you know the whole kind of Carl.
Yes, Michael and Carly, you mean? Carl, fan club. The fan club dude. Yeah, of course. I have not, again, like Blink-182, Weezer is this massive cult band where, again, any coverage on the Exclaim site or anywhere, they seem to just make the news. And so, you're younger than me. So a whole generation of people got into them around, that Beverly Hills song. And then the Green Album was before that, right?
It was before that, yeah. When I got into them, Rivers was still a recluse and hadn't released music in so long. And there was all this pressure for them to put out sort of a hit record, which was what they tried to do with Make Believe. Oh, man, I've got a good story as an aside about this. You know that band, Hot Hot Heat?
Oh, yeah, from Victoria or Vancouver or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so supposedly they were going to work with Rick Rubin on a record around that time, I think like after Bandages, something like that.
Yep.
And Rick Rubin said, I'll work with you guys, but the first single has to be, we're going to use the chord progression from Pour Some Sugar on Me, and it's going to be a hit.
What?
And it has to be that. And they kind of said, like, all right, we're not going to do this. But Weezer did, and the song is Beverly Hills.
So it's the exact chord progression as... Oh, yeah. It is the exact same chord progression. Rick Rubin is weird. That is really weird.
Yeah,
why would you pick that thing? Why would he get so fixated on that? That's weird.
I know.
Okay, wow.
But it was a hit, but very strange.
Well, I didn't know. I would not have... Was that commonly known that they had... They copied it. It's like the same chorus now.
I think that's like, I don't even know if I'm supposed to tell you that, but I don't care. So.
So you see Weezer.
I hope I don't get any exposure from saying that.
Exposure? I don't know if that's. Anyway, in 2004, you see Weezer. That's the first time seeing them?
Yep. And then I met Colin Medley, and he started taking me out to see. He was really into Jim Guthrie, Gentleman Reg, Toronto indie band. Yeah. So I think my first indie show was going to see the Three Gut Records closing party.
Okay.
And then got into like Final Fantasy, Arcade Fire, Wolf Parade.
Was the Three Gut thing you're talking about at like the Transac and Lee's Palace and stuff?
Yeah, it was at the Transac.
Do you remember me rapping with Jim Guthrie?
Yeah. Oh man, I didn't know it was you, but I do remember that. So you were at that show.
I was at that show, and I don't know how I ended up on stage. Jim used to do. Did I do It Takes Two? I feel like I did. At the end of maybe Turn Musician, Jim used to do his own. He would do a version of It Takes Two by Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. And I feel like that's what I did, or maybe I did something else. I might have done a hockey rap. I don't remember what was going on, but I did some sort of rapping.
I vaguely remember, you know, I mostly just remember the concert. I remember Gentleman Reg doing a Elliott Smith cover.
Pretty
awesome. I'm sorry, I didn't remember.
No, dude, don't apologize. I brought it up. I just know that it might have been something where I freestyled. I just did something, and I wasn't supposed to do it. And it was nice of Jim to call me up to do something. And anyway, so that's weird.
He's so cool.
He's great. Yeah, he's also one of my better best friends. You know, I play music of his on the show to end the show every week. So I talk about him just in that context in the outro. So yeah, Jim's a great. So anyway, that's cool. So that's how you got into. So basically, Colin Medley, who also an instigator for me doing this show, as I recall, it was like you should do the show or something. I can't remember, but anyway, yeah. So Colin is an instigator.
Yeah, Colin, and then I think through him I got on to Still Post.
Oh, right, the message boards, yes.
Which, kind of 8 months before it shut down, and that's how I also had like a bit of a problematically older friend in high school who, you know, not in that way, it wasn't like romantic, but he was King Kong and Barbecue Show's tour manager, so he would take me to see them and Deadly Snakes and sort of learned about Dan Burke via him and the Still Post scene, that kind of whole the cool Toronto punk culture scene.
Yeah, the Still Post thing was pretty good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I feel like they had satellite boards for like different regions, and you could also just participate in the Toronto discussions, and it was always very fun. Owen Pallett was pretty prominently on there, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And okay, so you're immersed in the indie rock world. Did it blow your mind coming from where you came from, like the classical world? Like, were you just like, holy shit, there's a whole other side to music? Like, do you have that memory?
Yeah, I think I remember seeing Owen Pallett right when he first started using loop pedals.
Mm-hmm.
And even then thinking like I could never do this. I think it took a while for me to make the connection, like what I'm doing on classical piano would equip me well to try and do music like what Owen Pallett is doing, but it just seemed like this sort of inaccessible other realm of like very talented musicians that I, you know, although I wish I had understood that they were closer than I thought.
Well, there's a certain, you mentioned Owen Pallett, and he is a very sophisticated, I got to be careful with this. I think there would be a perception that the indie rock or underground rock stuff would be less complicated than the classical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your perception? Because you mentioned Owen, who's also classically trained, formally trained, to do everything he can do. And he was at the forefront. He was among the real leaders in that community, inspiring mm-hmm. people, and playing ostensibly almost exclusively with violin and keyboards. Not necessarily indie rock instrumentation, if we want to be stereotypical about it. Like, I feel like you seeing Weezer on the one hand and other bands like that, but then also seeing what Owen or maybe Laura Barrett even.
Laura Barrett was huge.
Yeah, yeah. Like just seeing these people who figured out that they could apply their incredible talents and skills that for some of us would be like, oh, like that's highfalutin, you know, you got trained how to do stuff. Whereas some of us came from it like, I've never had one lesson. I've never mm-hmm. had any training. I just went at it. And that was kind of the spirit of what we were also supporting. So you're in an interesting realm, because I think you saw the passion and the power of people making stuff up as they went along, maybe not even knowing how to read music, but putting forth something really incredible. But you also had people like Owen and yourself and Laura Barrett, and there's probably a billion others that I'm missing right now, that really did know music inside and out,
mm-hmm.
but were also existing in this realm. Anyway, sorry, I'm
yeah, it's interesting to draw a parallel in my head between Barbecue. Have you seen Barbecue live before?
Yeah, I think I saw them at the, I want to say I saw them at the Horseshoe once.
Like he does somehow. The one-man band where he plays the drum set and guitar and sings.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. You're not talking about King Kong. King Kong.
No,
and
no.
Oh, sorry. But no, sorry. I don't think I've seen Barbecue then.
Oh, you gotta see him.
Is that an active entity?
I think so. I think he just did a couple shows last month. But yeah, I guess in a way, what he's doing is fundamentally not that different in terms of performance from what Owen Pallett's doing, kind of a lot of things at once very proficiently.
Mm.
But for Barbecue, there's this whole like, it's cool to not know music classically. Like, it's cool to have been untrained as a musician. I think that's a belief that even with the Beatles, like isn't there some... Like, John Lennon couldn't read music.
Paul
can't read music.
No, none of them could.
You know, but they could. Okay, I'm not going to dispute that. I haven't seen the documentary.
It's not just about the documentary. They did not know. And just ahead of the Get Back documentary, also on the Disney Channel, which I'll give them mm-hmm. a nice. They need a plug.
Yeah.
There's a documentary series between the aforementioned Rick Rubin and Paul McCartney. It features both of them kind of in conversation. And one of the reasons I just mentioned to you that I've been trying to go muck around on the piano or the keyboard in my basement now, one of the reasons is I stumbled upon someone excerpted a video from that Rick Rubin, Paul McCartney series where McCartney talks about how he thinks anyone could play piano. And he just goes through the motions of like, look, here's a chord. Here's six chords. There's three fingers, six chords. And from that, this is how we started. We didn't know how to play piano, John and I. We just started to muck around, figure out where the notes were, how to make chords, and then he starts playing some Beatles songs to demonstrate that the foundation of him and John having the time and patience to just try to figure the instrument out as best they could led him to write some of the most iconic piano parts probably of all time, right? Like, just, it's very fascinating. And that spirit is there too. Like, I'll just figure this out. But he makes a point, again, of saying, I can't read music. Don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. That calls in sort of this whole idea of authenticity. Like, is it more authentic to approach the instrument from the Beatles' perspective? You know, the gods, the Beatles, who, like, should you be ashamed of your classical upbringing kind of thing? Or, I mean, I would say that especially John towards the end was getting into more 20th century experimental music.
Sure. Well, which Yoko
in a way
well.
Was classical. Yeah.
Yeah. Yoko opened him up and Yoko could play. And that's
like Revolution 9 even is pretty.
Yeah.
I didn't get it before, but you know, the last couple of years I'm like, wow, this really is interesting that a top 40 artist released this song.
I think they were, despite their omnipresence and ubiquity and their early stuff, I think is really sophisticated for what it was. But I think I think they really approached music as open-ended, and that's what you discovered. You know, even when he was in the Beatles, George Harrison made a record called Wonderwall that's just, you know, like a noise experiment, basically, of some kind. Like, they seem drawn to every aspect of what you could do with music. I mean, you know, it's almost a cliche that Harrison went and made a point of learning how to play sitar, and he got trained. He went to see Ravi Shankar. Mm-hmm. Which taught him how to play. Like, that's a level of interest and curiosity and an understanding that music is potentially something that you can just constantly, like, you're never done learning, I guess. So I don't know if you have that. You get to go to the National, am I saying it right? It is called the National Music Center, right, in Calgary? The NMC?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you get to go there. Is that the first time you didn't, in February 2021, you were aware of it, of this system there, but had you ever encountered it in person before you got to go and play on it for this record?
So I met Malcolm at a trade show in 2016 at the NAMM show in Anaheim, and just approached this kind of mad scientist looking guy and said, "Who are you?" in my kind of weird spectrum-y way. And he told me all about Tonto, gave me an autographed CD, and got really especially into Stevie Wonder after that. And then I was on tour with the band White Horse in Calgary in the start of 2019. It was around Canada Day 2019, and had a day off, heard about Tonto, and wrote an email that was like, I was in Our Lady Peace, I play with Luc Doucet, you know. And
name dropping
every possible connection. Name dropping, which I try, I, you know, the Canadian in me hates, but sometimes you got to do it, and got a VIP tour, sort of like the one you got. And I posted about that, and then another cool social media thing, my friend Ross reached out to me. He's in the VR microphone industry, and he said, I know Robert Margalef quite well.
Oh.
If you ever want to get in touch with him, let me know. So I was in LA the following month for my brother's wedding. And met up with Robert then, and he was one of the few people who, I had a piano album out at that point and played him kind of my classical recordings, and he went like, oh, if you split this particular recording into four voices, you could make it a quartet.
What is that? For those of us, can you tell the people at home what that means? What does four voices mean?
So easiest way I can explain it is in Bach, if he's got preludes and fugues, and the preludes always have two voices, so it's sort of two melodies playing at the same time.
Right.
And melody and counter melody. A fugue will have three voices where there's a third melody that goes sort of in between the hands, and at that level of playing, you have to make each voice distinct, so it really functions like a three separate voices, even though it's two hands.
I see. Right.
So he said the way that that I like to compose, I don't know, would suit quartets if I wanted to do that.
Right.
And at that point, I knew about the residencies at the NMC. So Robert kind of endorsed me for doing this, which I think maybe helped juice my application a bit.
Oh, nice. That's amazing.
Yeah. So
this is after one encounter with you?
Yeah, yeah.
So this that's a nice testament to you, Robin. Like I think you're lovely and great, but like it's great. I feel like you meet people, you make an impression right away. You're talented, so they hear what you can do, and then they want you to what? Be in their bands. They want you to they help you juice up your application. That's great. I just wanted to say I think it's great.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thank you. That's nice of you to say.
Yeah. So that's cool. So then so they say, okay, if Robert vouches for Robin, we're sure. And so then the pandemic happens and everything's kind of screwy, I guess, in terms of timelines.
Yeah. It was supposed to happen July 2020 and then got pushed back to, I got the call the start of February and then it happened in March of this year.
So, okay. So is that the first? So you got to do the tour, but the March 2021, is that the first time you laid hands on the thing?
Yes.
Okay. So for those who haven't seen it, it is, I'll let you do it. Can you describe physically what it looks like to enter the room and then approach this machine? And then within that, I call it a machine. I don't know what else to call it. But within that, can you talk about how you laid these recordings down, if they're live, if it's just you by yourself running around the thing? Sorry, there's a lot for you to explain, but I just want to paint a picture for people.
Right, so it's massive. This it's very big. It's if you picture like a triptych painting, it sort of looks like a strange piece of abstract art that is also ergonomic.
It's like 10 feet tall, 8 feet tall. How tall is it? I can't remember. It's
yeah, I'd say it's eight or 9 feet tall.
Yeah,
and.
And it's shaped like a U?
It's shaped sort of room shaped, and the synths are built to kind of curve in towards the player so that you wouldn't be reaching up exactly vertically. The synths would kind of lean over so you wouldn't have to do that.
Right.
So what would I compare it to? I know I'll think of it in a bit. But the way that I recorded on it was, because I didn't have a ton of time, you can run MIDI into the synthesizer. So I pre-wrote in Logic basically MIDI compositions that then ran out as four separate channels into the ARPs, Oberheims, and Moog modulars. And the biggest challenge, I guess, was creating the tones themselves rather than the actual writing itself.
Right.
So I'm lucky that the software VSTs that they have now, sort of the Arturia modular and ARP software, has pretty accurate interfaces. So if you dial in a preset patch, it'll show you exactly what it looks like. So for the ARPs, I would use print-offs of those pictures plus the sort of original patch manual and just try and make as accurate or as close to what I demoed as I could. And then tuning it's a whole other kind of nightmare. And then
do you have to tune it or does an engineer tune it?
I would tune it. Like, the tuning itself isn't... It's not like kind of a guitar tuning with a Boss pedal. It's...
Yeah.
Or it is in theory, but it really is... You have to turn the knob just the tiniest bit. Otherwise, it'll just completely mess up. But then there's other sort of dials on the synthesizer where if you hit the wrong thing, the entire thing will detune all of a sudden. So
you
have to be really... It takes a long time.
What do you have, perfect pitch or something? Do you tune by ear? Is that how you tune?
I had tuners. I'd sort of try to tune by ear, but we also had room mics set up, or everything was running it through a PA in the room. And an interesting thing is there's kind of a Doppler effect with the synthesizer, so it could sound really in tune when you're standing in the kind of circle of the synthesizer.
Yeah.
Because you're hearing everything in conjunction with each other, and then you hear the playback, and it's like, this sounds... like shit, but
it's all very technical. I mean, that's the way of kind of, it's a very technical exercise. You have to know all the stuff you're saying. Like, I'm sure some people are like, oh, I know what that means, and other people listening might be like, I don't know what any of this means. But it's ostensibly you're just describing the process of just getting the thing running and you coming in prepared with music, but also I assume you are an improviser as well, right? Some of what we're hearing is a lot of what we're hearing is sort of improvised in some regard. Is that right?
I'd say four of the songs have overdubs from the other synthesizers that they let me bring into the studio, which was very cool as well. But most of the recordings are basically four sets of data which were running into the synthesizers that then spit out those particular sounds.
I see. Okay.
But you see why Stevie Wonder wanted to use this synth, because there was a guy who would sit in the booth who had perfect pitch and would manually tune things with the joystick as it was recording, sort of like he would auto-tune on the fly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, which, you know, I didn't... We don't have that luxury now. So when I mastered the album with Robert, he had me go back and retune a bunch of the recordings to sound... How can I explain this? So in orchestras, let's say you have three violins or two violins and a viola.
Yeah.
In order for them to sound in tune with each other, the first violin has to be detuned slightly by two or three cents, if you're thinking of it in terms of a guitar tuning pedal. And the lower note has to be kind of a bit higher in order for them to sound in intonation with each other. So everything being in tune would sound bad, but you have to go in and sort of individually retune each note so that it sounds both separate in terms of voices and as a single unit, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, but when Robert suggests you have to go and tweak these things, how do you do that? Do you have to replay them?
I had to... It was so embarrassing. I got Melodyne, the sort of auto-tune software.
Oh, okay.
But it wasn't even just click auto-tune. Like, I had to go in and each note retune by cents, and it took a long time.
Oh, man. Okay. But that's Robert's ear picking up on something. Like, would the average person have even noticed what Robert was talking about?
No, I don't think so. No, that's not true. I think it does sound better because I did that, but... It was
there's a lot of work.
Had I had 2 weeks at the NMC, I could have just done that there.
Yeah. So you're at the NMC, I think, by yourself. You said there was an engineer, but you're there ostensibly by yourself. But then the record, when it comes out, or before it's done, I should say, you have some guests. Is that right?
Yeah, I got a bit of Factor funding, and so I got some session players. Eric Slick is someone that I followed on Twitter for a year who... His wife went to high school with my internet friends from those message boards.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
So I had reached out prior to be like, isn't that, what a small world? And then said, like, do you want to play? You know, I'm sure you don't want to do this, but do you want to play on this? And then he agreed. And then I was friends with Nick Thorburn already. So Nick agreed and got sort of some cool players that way on the record to just kind of, I'm at this point, there, it makes the record sound incredible, or more incredible than it already is. I don't think that. But in terms of getting press, I thought it would help to have some big names associated with the project.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So you also have Leland Whitty from Bad Bad Not Good, right?
Yeah, who's just kind of, I think both him and Eric just did one take and they're real, you know, real deals.
Yeah, they're bonkers. And then, Joseph Shabison's on a tune, The Standoff, I believe. Yeah. And is Lowell Whitty as well. Is that Leland's brother?
It's Leland's brother, yeah. He's how I got in touch with Leland. I originally asked him to play drums on the track, and then Leland recorded it and reached out and said he would be interested. So
nice. So little, and then Laura Bates is the other person, right?
Yeah, we met playing in Isque's band.
Oh, nice.
Three or four years ago, and then she's got a great metal project called Volur, and then so I reached out to her.
Nice. Okay, so you have some friends. It's a little friendly, and you say, with all honesty, that you thought having some names would help just get the word out about the record. Well, the record's been out a little bit now. Was it received in a way that you were happy with? Were there?
I think so. I got a Wire review. I got some amazing press. I got a Wire review that just said it's not as good as the Stevie Wonder records.
Right, of course. Okay,
which is incredibly harsh and British, but also, you know, in some ways the best review I could have hoped for. And since that, I hope I never get a Pitchfork review because it, you know, gave me ego death for 3 days. But I hired a US PR guy for the first time, which I learned is the best way to get Canadian press.
Yeah, isn't it sad? Like I'm in the same boat. Like this show that you're on does not gargantuan, but the numbers compared to Canada in terms of, you know, listeners or whatever, the downloads, it's like massive in America compared to here. And mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend of mine about it the other day. And he's like, "Yeah, like," and he's like a Canadian person who's very familiar with the industry, and as I am, as you are now. And he was just like, "Yeah, it just might be too big for Canada." I'm like, I don't think it doesn't feel too big for Canada, the show, but at the same time, that speaks to something. It doesn't, for whatever reason, our media outlets care more about stuff that we make when people in America or England talk about it. And that's still the case. It's so bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I know it's strange, but I don't know. If you think about the bands that get successful, like Canadian successful here now and that we hear on the radio, maybe it makes a bit more sense.
Well, I think what we're both getting at is that for whatever reason, Canadians look for external validation before they recognize their own. So, yeah, anyway, that's there's probably some to it. Like, oh my God,
that's the Neil Young, Joni Mitchell model.
I guess so. I think it's just like, it's just frustrating because they sleep on it. It would be one thing if they were all over it and then it took off elsewhere. But it's usually the opposite, which I find, and they don't, no one learns from that. So it's confusing, and I don't understand it either, and I've been a part of it working at CBC. Sorry, I would say I never believe in that stuff. I just think you cover what you like, or you talk to who you like, and mm-hmm. it doesn't matter where they're from. That's my philosophy, and I know there's things like Canada Land, or there's other shows that are like, we only talk about this genre of music, but that's just not how I work personally. Like, I think, mm-hmm. I'm sure you're the same. You just process information from all over the world, and it has equal footing as maybe not as much as maybe your friends in your community doing well. That's a bit different. Mm-hmm. That's a different feeling. But I'm not a nationalist when it comes to art. Like, what the hell? So, anyway.
There's definitely more people in the States for niche content, which I would say what both of us are doing would qualify as maybe alternative.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, covering underground or making or covering slightly subversive stuff. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that's
whereas in Toronto, I feel like if you say you're doing that, you have to prove yourself to an entire indie scene of people that with these, you know, specific record labels that have certain tastes in noise and modular. It's like you have to impress a bunch of people that can't help you at all in order to get a very small amount of success in Toronto. But if you just put your music out online, you'll find a bunch of, you know, video game fans or podcast hosts who connect with your music without even having to go through all this, you know, Get On, Buzz Records or... hand-drawn Dracula or so on.
I hear what you're saying. I don't know. It's all sort of luck and timing and maybe what people are even ready for. I wasn't there, but I remember hearing a story that Chad Van Galen was playing at, I want to say it was at the Great Hall, probably for something like North by Northeast or Canadian Music Week or something like that. And apparently the show was sold out, but he was actually playing before someone else. And after he was done, apparently most of the room emptied, and the next person up on stage was Grimes. And then subsequently, we kind of know what happened there. I'm not extolling the virtues of... I love Chad. I helped Grimes set up her stuff at Hillside once, and it was a slight ordeal, but also fine. Like, I helped her just get everything. It was a quick transition, so I was there.
That time was wild. That was the Mac DeMarco year, too. I think
at Hillside
or at North by Northeast.
Oh yeah, maybe like it was. Yeah,
when he famously put the pencil in his butt.
Right. Were you at that Chad Van Galen show though? That I was.
No. I never went out.
You never went out. I just heard that people left. Not it wasn't anything against Grimes per se. Just they didn't know who she was. And I mean the first Arcade Fire show I set up in Guelph. It was a tiny little bar, and admittedly, it was too long a bill, but it was just one of those situations where they wanted someone to play, and local headliner a local artist wanted their friends to play, so it was a bit of a long bill, but they played last and everyone kind of split. And the first song they played was Wake Up, and everyone who was there was like, what the fuck is this? Like, holy shit. Yeah. And I'd already seen them a couple of times, so I kind of knew what they were about. But anyway, yeah, it's just weird timing stuff.
I saw Grimes actually at a house party that year, and I was stoned, and I laughed, like, too loudly during her set, and she made eye contact with me. It was just, you know, 20 people in a backyard, and it probably came from a place of jealousy or something. She had the same synthesizer as me, and I didn't have any... I'd never checked out Joanna Newsom or... I didn't understand strange women in music at that point.
Interesting.
So, but then... It was actually, yeah, my American friends telling me about Grimes after the fact, ironically, that made me go, oh, I guess what she's doing is kind of cool. I was just coming from my sort of... It reminds me of the comedy community in the sense that when I worked at Second City, I had to watch a bunch of old stock footage of Second City performances.
Uh-huh.
And the Chicago audiences are very kind and laugh at everything, including stuff that's not very funny, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Versus the Toronto crowds where it's dead silence. Everyone's really critical and the stuff's funnier.
Well, I mean, Toronto is notoriously known as the screw face capital. You know, you go to shows and if people aren't watching you with their arms crossed, you know, prove it.
Yeah.
Prove it to me. They're talking over your set. And so that's been my experience. Like whenever I would go to anything in America, if I went to a I went to a baseball game in Chicago, and it changed my life because I'd only been to Blue Jays games at the Sky Dome,
mm-hmm.
and it was all just like loud music and like advertising and like people being complete assholes, like the the fans. And then I went to Wrigley Field, and it was beautiful. It was before they, I think they've subsequently changed it. I went in like 2013, I want to say, or 2014, and with Colin Medley, oddly enough. He and I were there with Fucked Up. Fucked Up were making a record at Electrical Audio. And I got to go down with Colin and we filmed some stuff and made some stuff with Fucked Up. But anyway, Josh from Fucked Up and Colin and I, at Josh's suggestion, we decided to catch a Cubs game. It was great. It was like amazing. People seemed to respect the game. There was no... The PA announcements were like, by the way, don't forget to check out Bill's insurance. You know Bill? Bill from on that street? Go to his insurance place. It was very quaint and old-timey. And, you know, we were right by the scoreboard. It was great. And so, yeah, this mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. I think maybe Canadians realize that something's not right about how we do things. And so we're all kind of cynical and unforgiving compared to Americans who, like you said earlier, maybe they're just a little more relaxed and can deal with stuff in a way that we can't. So I don't know. Anyway, just rambling. Before we go to,
interesting.
Well, I don't know. Do you have any? Do you want to say anything about this perspective?
No. I thought that was. I think that's cool how you tied that in a bow. Okay. There. That was really. Yeah, I loved it.
Now, in terms of what we've talked about, the sounds we've talked about, your interest in music and why Tonto appealed to you, and the connections you made that got you there, and the subsequent connections you made to get people on the record or work on the record in some capacity. There's been some language about the record that suggests some of it is about you processing emotions wordlessly. And did you want to say anything about that? And is there something we can look out for in terms of that emotive quality?
I think, I mean, I expanded on it a bit in interviews. Like I like named the guy who like abused me in a relationship a long time ago during the pandemic, and sort of, it's always been a big source of shame. And also since becoming sober, I've realized it's been one of the reasons why it's stressful for me to play in bands, because I was also in a band with that person a long time ago. So I think I became interested in sort of a neoclassical perspective about using a composition the way you'd see a piece of art in a gallery where it says, you know, this is the meaning of this abstract painting or something like that. Yeah. So I think setting out to write compositions where the goal is to tell a story or a narrative is more interesting to me than traditional harmony theory. It's like one of the reasons I didn't go to school for for music, but the song Airplane that Laura Bates plays on is sort of the most, the one where I really tried to pour all of my emotions into that song, I guess, in terms, as a way to, selfish way for me to heal. Yeah. And it's called Airplane because I think when you're working through trauma in therapy, you realize that it's not the responsibility of other people in your life to have to listen to you talk about that stuff all the time. It's sort of on you to work through it yourself. Mm. And it, you know, in order to stop playing the victim all the time, because my ultimate goal is to be a likable person, I guess, to that doesn't kind of bombard people with that. But in music, when you're, you know, working on your own stuff, you can do whatever you want. So I call it Airplane because I was thinking about the guy in the movie Airplane who's always telling people about his trauma until they kill themselves.
Right, I see.
Which just made me laugh, kind of sick, twisted humor is kind of a... But then manages to land the plane safely at the end anyway, just a funny joke to myself. But then also sort of the suffocating, like, awful feeling of being, you know, sexually assaulted. That was the other side of it.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize this. I'm very sorry to hear that, Robin.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Visha.
No, don't. Well, don't apologize. I don't know what else to say but that. And I appreciate that. I mean, from what you're saying, for what it's worth, I think it's good that you've figured out a way to deal with it and put that forth in your music. That's very brave of you. And again, may be saying a bunch of stuff that's cliche, but I don't know what else to say. I think it's true.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you. I'm not sure if I agree with the whole Me Too movement, but I think that another issue I had was this guy was still showing up at my concerts, like, up until 3 or 4 years ago. And sort of, I think something that the Me Too movement did do was made it a bit easier to tell, you know, a door person, don't let this guy in, without kind of having to encounter backlash. Like,
right.
Why are you saying this, you know, crazy woman? So I think it has helped in that sense. So, thank you for saying
well,
that.
Well, you're welcome. And I appreciate you speaking on it as candidly as you always do when you cover subject matter. I do appreciate your candor and I appreciate you making this record. As we're speaking, I don't know if it's possible to really have plans that you can actually execute, but do you have plans to either tour or release new music in 2022? Is there anything coming up that you want to talk about?
So I am going actually on tour in Fucked Up next month on keyboards, which I'm really excited about for their David Comes to Life tour.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah, I just had Mike and Josh from Fucked Up on the show talking about David Comes to Life extensively. So I think you know we're friendly and I'm a fan of theirs.
They're the coolest.
Yeah, well, that's great. They asked you to... so you're in the band. What are you going to do? You're going to play some sort of keyboards or something?
On synthesizers, yeah. So I, you know, where usually the holiday season's kind of depressing, it's been very exciting to go through these songs and arrange guitar parts for keyboards and so on. And I think rehearsals are starting next week.
Oh,
or the end of next week, yeah.
So that's amazing, if I may, and I don't mean to be a downer. Do you think do you think those shows will actually happen?
I don't know. But you know what? I passed the Zappa Plays Zappa audition just before the pandemic, and then the pandemic happened. So I'm prepared for the...
What was that again? I know there's something to do with Dweezil Zappa, but for the folks, can you tell the folks listening at home what Zappa Plays Zappa was all about?
So it's Frank Zappa's son who plays his father's music live on tour. I think it's not called Zappa Plays Zappa anymore. It's called the Dweezil Zappa Experience, but it's a big kind of rite of passage as a musician. Steve Vai famously, you know, and George Duke have had these crazy audition stories where Frank was real crazy. So it made them play like Hawaiian style 7/8 on the fly. And
is
so I had heard about... go ahead.
I was just going to say, is Dweezil similarly eccentric?
He is known to go on YouTube covers that fans of Zappa will post and write, you know, you made this mistake in the comments.
Oh my God. Okay. But you encountered Dweezil and passed the audition. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I was in LA for a trade show with a microtonal synthesizer that I was like a brand rep for, and heard about this audition. And this was actually, you know, 2 days after the first Long Winter where we had our interview.
Oh yeah. And, yeah, I feel like we talked about the fact that you were going to do that. That's right. I remember that now. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't go to the trade show. I transcribed 5 Zappa songs in 3 or 4 days and then sent him videos, and we went for coffee, and it was like, it was going to be a Deep Purple tour, opening for Deep Purple that summer across Europe, which would have been like insane. So at any rate, I'm prepared for sort of the ego hit of what happens if it
right.
if this tour doesn't go forward. It's just such an honor that they thought of me at all.
You're saying, sorry, so the Zappa Play Zappa or whatever it is called now, that didn't happen in the end is what you're saying?
No, because of the pandemic. Right. That was, 3 weeks before the lockdown.
So does that suggest that if things were to resume, like, have you been in touch with them since then? Would you, if they were to plan to do it again, would you be involved, do you think?
Well, the reason they needed a player was because King Crimson was reuniting that summer, and they were sniping some of his players for their band. So I doubt it.
Oh, okay.
Plus, like, I way overposted about it because I think during the pandemic I just went, you know what, I'm just going to tell everybody on my social media that I did this.
Well, you're proud of yourself too, right?
Yeah, totally. But there's this weird, like, is it a bad look if I, if I say, you've always got to kind of watch out for that stuff.
Sure.
Which I've learned the hard way, unfortunately, a bunch of times on Twitter. But I don't know. He's reached out, to say, he said Happy New Year to me last year, but it's.
Right. Okay. Well, he felt a connection, and then perhaps there'll be a collaboration later down the line. You are a little unfiltered on Twitter. I said that I appreciate your candor, but you do sometimes say things that I can see. Are you deliberately trying to put people off? Are you deliberately trying to provoke people into a reaction? Because sometimes you're very funny, but sometimes you say things I'm like, ooh, I don't know about that one. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, definitely. I think sometimes I don't even know what I'm... One time I posted... as a joke, like, completely, the Cake or the Devo of our time.
Right.
And it went, not viral, but some of the kind of cool New York art scene people were talking about it and just tearing into me as though I was being completely earnest. And I'm in a group chat on Twitter with a bunch of Toronto people where the rule is kind of, I don't say, it's not like a gang or whatever, but there's like an unspoken rule that if that happens, see how long you can take it without telling people it was a joke.
Yeah, there's a few people who do this well, where they'll tweet something deliberately dumb or deliberately tone deaf or provocative in a way just to see what happens. So you're saying you're part of that school of thought sometimes. So some of the things you've said, you're saying just to be not a troll. Is that trolling? I can't tell.
I don't know. I think
that's what the alt-right does, right? Like, that's what the alt-right trolls have done. They've taken the kind of part of comedy that was fun, where you just say and do something so sort of seemingly obviously false or extreme,
mm-hmm.
but people know your tone of voice, so they recognize that maybe you're goofing around. Now everyone takes everything that everyone says seriously first. So you can have fun with those people, but also, like you say, you might get people who are like, well, fuck Robin. The thing she said was so awful that I think I'm done. You know, like you might get that too, right?
Yeah. Like it, I mean, the Kanye West, I posted a side-by-side photos of a review Kanye West got on the Donda album next to the one review I've ever received at this point in The Guardian, which had 4 stars and his had 2 stars. And I said, try harder next time, Kanye. And it went viral, people saying as a joke that I was racist, but, cut to 10 days later, I'm on the phone with Bashir Mohammed in Edmonton,
mm-hmm.
Who I believe is the head of Black Lives Matters there, who was, you know, legitimately hurt by what I'd said. And, you know, for...
Right. There you go. So you, so does that give you pause the next time you write something where, you know, you're kind of trying to pick at people? Does that give you pause before you do it, or what? What happened?
I think it took a few months. Like, I was about to go on tour at that point. That's another factor, is you can never know. You have to ask yourself, what were my motivations in doing this? You know, was I coming from a stressed out point of view when this all happened, and so on? You know, look after yourself. But I think Bashir brought that up on the phone too, the kind of alt-right movement and trolling and so forth.
Oh, he did. That's weird. I just made that. I mean, I didn't make it up. That's interesting. Okay. So that's what they were seeing as well. Like, that line is blurry these days, I have to say.
Yeah. You know, I follow people who, you know, posted on those same message boards where the alt-right formed and so on. But I don't think they would consider themselves alt-right. But I, in terms of sort of coping with mental illness, I've found a lot more connection in sort of being basement dweller loners with those people, in terms of like using humor as a way to cope. Yeah. But I think that when you have a sort of brand to worry about, it's funny. I didn't know he was going to be on your podcast, but I posted a quote tweet of Steve Albini, you know, saying something about the vaccine and so on, mm-hmm. A few weeks ago, that I don't think was super provocative. I'm just such a huge fan. I was like seeing if he would engage with me mostly.
Yeah.
And he had a thread about a month ago that was how he was like feels bad about creating edgelord culture, something like that.
Yeah, we talked about that. So Steve's been on the show once a year since I've started this show, and we've had a long history of talking to each other since the mid-2000s, and I did ask him about that on the most recent episodes. This, by the way, was me
I can listen to it.
It's just an interjection to plug my own show. Sorry, but yes.
No, it was great. I, you know.
Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
But it's weird. I was like, I kind of had a... After I did that, I had a bit of a change of heart in terms of some of the more extreme-minded people that I was interacting with, that it's almost like when someone gets canceled in the community, to use that as an example, like you have to take things on a case-by-case scenario. Like we know about cancel culture, mm-hmm. It's not really real. If somebody gets canceled,
right?
But it does affect how people, interact with their friends. You know, you don't see comedians talking about Louis C.K. online anymore, whether or not they're still privately consuming the content.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, it is maybe not the best look to engage with people who are actively, you know, using racial slurs, whether or not they're doing that as a, you know, compulsive sort of intrusive Tourette's type thing. Someone who visits your page for the first time doesn't know that necessarily, so...
Well, there were time-wise you could also say that if someone did something unusual, you could say, with little reservation, they're being crazy.
Yeah, totally.
And you can't... So the Kanye thing is, as you know, I think, Robin, we would have done some Kanye material in our wedding band, right? Did we?
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge fan.
Right. And I know you probably are. But the thing is, he's done so much problematic, terribly terrible stuff, damaging stuff to his community and beyond, certainly in the Trump era. Dodgy before that, sure. Some of the raps I cringe at now that I kind of let go by, you know? But that's mm-hmm. a context thing. All this to say, he is suffering from trauma mm-hmm. and mental health issues. And I think, so there is a school of thought, like when I talk to Backwash about Kanye West, or I talk to DJ SB about Kanye West, they're all like, I'm sorry, I'm there for him. Like, I don't want to paraphrase what they said. Like, I think they recognize what he's doing is wrong in a lot of ways, but he's also made the greatest music of this century, certainly in his realm. And has influenced all sorts of things on a Beatles level, like socioculturally.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the same thing about John Lennon.
Yes, exactly, right. And I, so, And yeah, Lennon had the same stuff. Like, that's the only real excuse for the really, really horrible stuff we've heard about his first marriage, is that, if there's any excuse possible, I mean, is that, like, his life was driven by pain. Like, all of what he did was driven by pain. And I think he really, I will say as an aside, my thing is, I thought he tried to atone for that,
yep,
as much as he possibly could.
That's
throughout the 70s. Yeah. And the 60s. Like, yeah. So there's, I think we have to forgive people here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's unforgivable, of course. And I'm sure coming from where you come from and experiencing what you've experienced, you can recognize that some people are never going to be forgiven.
Yeah.
But, and should not be. But there's other, so Kanye spent 15, 16, 17 years making some of the best music possible, saying some weird shit, but also saying some great shit. I still think that, God damn, the balls on that guy for going on that telethon and saying George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Yeah,
and
great.
Writing raps about how it's conspiratorial, but to suggest that the government, he'll say, like, I know the government administers AIDS. Like, that's pretty out there. That's like, on the one hand, that's pretty out there. But what he's really saying is, I know they're letting it decimate my community.
Yeah, it's being produced
on purpose.
Upon, yeah, systemic.
Same way as crack and everything else. Like, there's a reason to think those things because there's some fact in it. Anyway,
it was weird to what I was arguing with some people about during this whole thing was that what I was doing was punching down on Donda West because of the disproportional rate at which women of color are subjected to medical malpractice, which is
right
an interesting, like, which I completely agree with the second part. It was interesting to be accused of punching down, and it's also like a slippery slope that I don't want to get involved in.
Wow.
Online,
so people were as much, they were upset as much about what you did because the album happened to be called Donda?
Yes, because, you know, you never know something's going to blow up.
Yeah.
Early on, someone said, like, you think you're better than Kanye? And I replied, ball don't lie. Like,
yeah.
Without thinking, but, you know, someone who doesn't know me, it was construed as using AAVE.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Which it's like, I see examples where I'm like, that's white tears. That's white female tears. And I agree with you. It was very frustrating to be on the receiving end of it. And you can't really go, I'm not like that. Cause it, you know, it just makes people make more fun of you. I think for the most part, it was fine. It was hard to, you know, I think at one point the most crazy I went was I replied to somebody with wearing like a Black Lives Matter shirt. Like, I consider myself like a radical anti-racist, and it was so frustrating to encounter a bunch of strangers who, you know, I also don't like talking about it on social media.
You tried to make a joke. Ostensibly, what this boils down to is you tried to make a joke and it wasn't seen as such. And that's a lot of where comedy's at these days. And it's also the realm of a lot of, no offense to you, and this is not meant to be disparaging.
No.
There's a lot of amateur comedians out in the world now, and some of them are funnier than the professionals. And some of them are just trying things. And that's a lot of what comedy is, just trying something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if it lands badly, it lands badly. But usually in the old days, they would land badly in a room full of, if you're lucky, a couple hundred people at the most, and then you fix it.
Yeah.
And now everyone's trying out their open mic stuff on Twitter or wherever, and sometimes it does well and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes there's nuance that's missed,
mm-hmm.
Maybe purposefully, you know? That's a lot of, like, just trying to weaponize someone's words. That's the new pastime. You said this, well, it could mean this. And then the person says, well, no, that's clearly not what I meant. I meant this. It doesn't matter. I interpreted it to mean this. So I mostly don't do anything on these things for these reasons, because I remember once at CBC there, someone was like, hey, that tweet, probably a tweet about the urinal or something. I had some bad, dumb tweet about a urinal that I did that I thought was kind of funny, but it was dumb. Like, I knew it was dumb, but you also assume that's not your legacy, right? So you tweet mm-hmm. that, and you assume it's a tweet that will be fleeting. And then what it becomes for some people is your legacy. Oh, Robin Hatch. I know that name. That's the person who did that tweet about Kanye and Donda West.
Yeah.
So that you there's these micro legacies that emerge from microblogging that you have to be careful about, I think. Oddly, yeah, that's all it is. Like, I appreciate your brashness. Like, just so the record, let the record show, you've been on some iteration of this show twice, both in the Long Night capacity. I take the Long Night talk show and I turn it into a podcast episode. But I do a thing for Exclaim where I round up tweets that I think are funny. That's like a weekly assignment I have. And I included one of yours. And the reason we're having this conversation, in a sense, is because you quote tweeted their post about the funny tweets thing. And you used it as an opportunity to quasi taunt me into having you on the show. And I was like, what, Robin, what is going on? Like, were you offended that you weren't on the show? Is that what happened?
I think I was just being kind of like joking or something like
uh-huh.
that.
You were joking.
Oh, but also you had just had Steve Albini on, and I felt kind of weirdly guilty about, it's so arrogant of me to assume, you know, everyone's visiting my page and or delusional. Like I also don't think that, but I was like, that was right around the time I was thinking, was he onto something when he said, you know, I need to scale back being an edgelord. I had seen that and went like, oh, I'm so embarrassed that I, you know, said that. I need to be thinking more professionally now that I'm going to be playing keyboards and fucked up or something. So then I just also said that because I thought you might laugh at it.
Right. No, I did. And I reached out and I said, sure, let's do it. Like I'm so busy. I saw Joseph Shabison listed as someone on your record there as a credit. And Joe reached out to be on the show because he put out at least two great records this past year. And he's been on the show before. And I said, sure. But what I think I even said, I called him yesterday because I felt so bad that I wasn't able to make it happen. And what I told him, I think even at the time when he initially asked, was, just so you know, for whatever reason, I have 3 months worth of episodes recorded. Like, this pandemic has been so weird for me and my practice. Everyone's kind of around, I guess, that mm-hmm. I'm working ahead to such a crazed extent that I have to miss people and records that I want to talk about, because I'm just like, when am I going to put that out? I also am with advertisers or whatever. Like, I have to be like, here's my plan for next month, and I don't often vary it. I'm like, I really should be doing one a week. I shouldn't be doing two a week because it's too much, and I can't keep up with it. And I have a day job and I have a family. Like, I can't do it. So anyway, that's just so we're clear. I like you. I'm a fan of yours, and I'm a fan of Joe's, and I have to, that's all it is. I'm a little rammed and slammed, and I'm just doing my
best.
That's
great.
Yeah, it is good, but I don't want anyone to feel like, why didn't Vish have me on the, I also like, it's
well,
a
no, you have celebrities, you have like actual famous people on your podcast. Like, I honestly didn't expect you to reach out to me, so.
Well, you have
you
have tweeted some things that have given me some pause, and I will say that too, because I'm like, oh,
like,
man.
Which ones?
You really want to get into this? I don't know if
yeah.
I want to get into it. Well,
Leo, it's like Marc Maron. Let's
okay,
well,
quickly, because we're already, what are we at here? We're almost at 2 hours. Okay, I'm going to do this. I'll say it, and you tell me if it was a joke or not. But
okay.
I was a little offended as a fan of Bob Dylan's when you went after Bob Dylan.
Oh, okay.
You went after Bob Dylan when those, and I don't, as we're speaking, I don't know if these accusations are valid, but someone came out to say that in like 1965 or 66, they were abused by Bob Dylan, and it was roundly like, what the hell? That was the initial reaction, like, holy shit, because he's someone who's been pretty clean from as far as we know. I mean, guy from the 60s, 70s, who knows, but he's been pretty mm-hmm. much a family guy and all that sort of stuff. But this accusation came out, and then shortly after the accusation came out, there were a few people who were like, well, the timeline doesn't make sense. He wasn't in the country, mm-hmm. let alone in New York City when this person is claimed. Like, he wasn't. It's all on the record. He made a film. there's film. There's a famous documentary about him being out of the country at this time. So that gave me a little bit of relief, because I don't know if you know this, but I adore his music. And I got the sense that from your tweet that A, you thought the accusations were probably true, and B, that you didn't like his music. So I was like, being honest with you here. Okay, go ahead.
I like Bob Dylan. I had just broken up with someone who is a massive Dylan fan, and did that to bother him.
Were we dating? Am I unaware of our relationship? Because it seemed I took it personally, and I don't know what it was.
No, so I think a lot of people did, but I did that. You know, at that point, I think just angry at my house. And I did
okay,
that because I was pissed off.
But no one would know this. That. You went at him. You called him like a pedophile.
I know.
And you said his music was garbage or something. Like, it was way too much. And I was like, okay.
It was bad. I was like unhinged at that point. I like Bob Dylan, though. He's like the best.
But he's not. Would you agree that by the sounds of things, he probably isn't? Sorry, let's not even get into the allegations, because that'll come to light.
There's a lot we don't know about
the
best classic rock musicians. And
absolutely.
But I'm a huge Steely Dan fan, and Donald Fagen, someone who's publicly, you know, punched women. You know, there's times where I will separate the art from the artist.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
that is interesting. If you ever do listen to the Albini interview I just did, again, been a fan forever, saw Shellac for the first time in 1998, and still when I play a guitar or the drums, my default is to kind of emulate something that his band has done. However, something came to light from a mutual friend of ours who like, do you know, he's famously been in one a band with a terrible, awful, awful name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But a friend of mine sent me a link to another one-off project he was associated with, which he explained on the episode. I didn't say the name, but it's worse. It's a worse name on the face of it. However, after his context for what it was and his role in it, I was left feeling okay about it. Not great, but still okay about it. And he acknowledged that it was wrong-headed on several levels, but also explained where it may have came from. So all this to say, I've taken a moment out of our conversation here to ask you about a specific tweet that's now we're on the record with it. And so you will acknowledge that sometimes you go on Twitter in a state where you feel like you're just going to provoke people or exercise something that's bothering you. And it might not even be about the subject matter at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Kanye thing was also you reckoning with your own agency as an artist who gets the coverage you get. And you were comparing yourself to arguably the most famous person on the planet right now, which is...
As a joke.
To me, that's obviously a joke, but other people don't take it that way. And I will tell you, as someone who likes comedy and jokes and feeling just like... So my breath was taken away by the Dylan stuff, and I'm okay with it now because once the sort of public investigation occurred, I'm like, right, he wasn't even like, what the hell? Like, this doesn't even make any sense. So maybe it's, what could this be? But maybe more information will come to light and I'll eat my words. But it would obviously be crushing to me to learn that he did something that terrible. But at the same time, as most of the people I admire seem to have done at least one questionable thing. And so then it puts you on your heels a bit. Like, what am I? I've devoted my life to loving this person and their work from afar, or I go see them every time they're around. What did I do? Like, what was I supporting? Anyway, thank you for explaining this.
I thought it was I'm an arrogant, or my ego is ultimately, privately, I'm quite confident about myself as a creative. I thought it was a bit of a Dylan move for me to, for people to not really know what I was talking about.
It was pretty harsh. I got to say, if I remember correctly, it was pretty harsh, but I appreciate that you weren't even mad at him, or you don't necessarily believe what you wrote completely. I mean, more information has to come out.
No.
Okay.
I really said it to get a rise out of one person.
Well, I hope it worked. Did you hear back from that person? Were they upset?
No. I mean, that's... Of course not.
Okay. All right. Robin, so you've got some fucked up plans, and then otherwise, where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
My Bandcamp, robinhatch.bandcamp.com. You know, Google Robin Hatch. Find some articles about me.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds good. And
I got some vinyls coming out on January 15th is when they're in. So
you have Tonto of the Tonto vinyls.
Tonto vinyls.
Okay,
yeah.
good. Are you saying vinyls ironically, or is that how you talk?
It's supposed to be vinyls.
No, it's supposed to be vinyl.
No, it is vinyls.
No, it's not. That's a Josiah Hughes move. You're making fun.
What? Is he making that up?
Yeah, it's not.
No,
vinyls.
It is vinyls.
No, it's not. It's a joke.
No.
That's what people who don't know how to say vinyl say it, and that's what he. That's Josiah. Our friend Josiah Hughes loves making fun of people who say vinyls. So anyway, it's fine.
Are you joking me?
No, I'm telling you the
truth. That's so embarrassing.
It's actually. I thought you were. Anytime I've seen you use it, I assume you were following his school of thought.
I really? Love okay. Okay. Cool.
We've learned
okay, cool.
a lot.
Yeah, that's
about
definitely. That's what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll say well, that's what you're doing. So look out for the.
Oh my God.
Tonto vinyls. To hit the shelves or the online record stores. If we can give people a taste of Tonto, by the way, Tonto, how is that even acceptable in this day and age? You know, with
I have
Tonto,
a land. Yeah,
you've taken care of it, but I can't believe we're talking about a thing called Tonto, which, for those who don't remember, was a character in the Lone Ranger series that was indigenous or Native American. Anyway, let's not get into that. That's just
called Fu Manchu or something.
It's an acronym. It's not really named after Tonto. What's a song from Tonto?
And that's something I said to the Kanye guy was like, if you're going to call me up for anything, like, why don't you look at my pinned tweet?
You double down. That's fucking funny.
Yeah.
Okay, if we could play a song from Tonto there, Robin, what can we play? Can you pick one and tell us why you chose it?
I guess you can play My Lucid Mind. I like that one a lot. I'm embarrassed. I think it kind of, unfortunately, sounds like the Simpsons theme a bit, but I love Danny Elfman, so I think it's my most interesting composition.
Okay. I like the Simpsons as well. Again, you can pick up Tonto on vinyl on Robin's Bandcamp. This is My Lucid Mind. Robin, I love you very much. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I appreciate you reaching out and prodding me to make it happen on Twitter, which is your way of getting it under people's skin. It worked. But I do care a lot about you, and I'm glad you're doing stuff. And thank you for this, and best luck in the future.
Thanks for having me, Vish, and likewise. And it's it's been great to catch up.
Thank you.
Well, thanks once again to Robin Hatch for appearing on this, the 659th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook if you want to, and also follow the show on Twitter, at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram, at vishkana. Also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. We've had some nice donations lately, so thank you very much to those of you around the world contributing to our Patreon. A reminder that $6 or more a month grants you access to some exclusive content, including bonus material from current episodes, like the one with Robin. If you enjoyed this chat with Robin, we sat down and did a little bit of overtime and a little. I've been asking people about their current obsessions, and we just see where that goes. So Robin had a response to that, and if it's not up already on the Patreon, it will be up in the next day or so. So check that out. And again, for those who donate $6 or more, you have access to all sorts of exclusive content, not just from this show or current episodes, but I dig into my audio archives, air it. Heck, maybe I'll find that old Sheezer interview. I don't know, that I did with Robin and that band. I don't know. I think I have that. Anyway, my point is this. If you're interested in any of this, oh, and also if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I will get you one while supplies last. Again, the address you need to know there is patreon.com/creativecontrol. I want to thank, who do I want to thank here? Oh, yes, the absolutely great Alberta-based record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about at their website, blackbird.ca. And also, I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, each located respectively in Guelph, Ontario, and also Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. You can learn more about all these places via the podcast description. There should be links there. Also want to thank my friend Jim Guthrie, who was mentioned on this episode. He lends me music for this show, and you can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this super long, I don't mean it in a negative way, but this was an unusually long episode with Robin. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to Creative Control on the podcast thing that you use. Subscribe or follow the show and maybe tell your friends about it and help spread the word about the show. That would be helpful. And that's it. I want to go. I have to go. I have to go shovel. There's lots of snow. And my wife went out there first, so I gotta go. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.